Hello and welcome to the fifth episode of the History Show on Near 90 FM. My name is Cathal Brennan and as always I'm joined by my co-presenter John Dorney. If you want to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, check out our podcast page on nearpodcast.org/pcast/. On today's show we'll be looking at the 1916 Rising. We're very pleased to be joined on the phone by Fergal McGarry. Dr. Fergal McGarry is a senior lecturer in modern history at Queen's University Belfast. He has written a series of books on Irish republicanism, including Irish Politics and Spanish Civil War, Frank Ryan, Owen O'Duffy, A Self-Made Hero, and The Rising, Ireland, Easter 1916, and edited the collection Republicanism in Modern Ireland. Roisin Higgins got her first lectureship in Economics and Social History at the University of Manchester, then moved to lecture at the University of Edinburgh. On returning to Ireland, she worked in University College Dublin and Queen's University Belfast, before moving to Boston College, Ireland. Roisin is currently working on the Irish Sporting Heritage Project, which has been building an inventory of historical and contemporary sporting sites around Ireland. And John Dorney, who's usually my co-presenter, is now on the other side of the fence as an interviewee. He has written on the 1916 Rising and published an e-book on that, and he also writes for the IrishStory.com website. So first off, John, why do you think the Easter Rising has such an enduring hold on people's imaginations?
Well, a lot of people have written about this, a lot of them who know a lot more about the Rising than I do, but I think in the end, the reason the Rising, we're still talking about the Rising today, is because the Rising is such a powerful myth. You know, it's the Rising, supposedly it's the Irish people taking on the British Empire. I mean, or if you prefer, it's the determined minority, the ones who stand for principle, who are taking on the British Empire. They fight fairly, they fight cleanly against, you know, overwhelming odds. In the end, they get executed unjustly, you know, by the tyrannical empire, and the people come onto their side. And the... it's easy to kind of mock that myth, and some, all of us do probably sometimes, but it's, the fact is that there's enough truth in it for it to be very powerful even today. And it can be used for all kinds of things, not only Republican things, but also ideas of, for example, the current government can use it saying to promote ideas of economic self-sacrifice, you know, ideas of good citizenship. But the reason it's, we're still talking about it today is, one, because the myth is so powerful. The other reason is because it has become the founding story of the state, rightly or wrongly, which might not be totally accurate, but it has become that. So it has those two functions. One is a powerful story in itself, another one as the state story.
I would agree with that completely. I think really what gives it its power, you know, there are two elements to that myth that really have given it a power down the years. And one is the fact that it wasn't in itself a military victory. So what you have here is the privileging of service and sacrifice over victory, and that's why it's very useful for a state, particularly in peacetime. It's very problematic whenever you know, when a country's not at peace, but during peacetime that's the kind of thing that can be domesticated and employed in order to advocate service on behalf of the state. And the other central feature, that central ideological moment, the reading of the proclamation. Also, that's one of the powerful things, because Pierce imagines a new reality, and he opens the doors of what can be imagined in Ireland. And since then, I think Irish people have been arguing and sometimes violently fighting over what that republic should look like.
Yeah, I would agree with much of that. I think John has certainly pinpointed the two functions which mean that the Easter Rising will always be relevant. One, that it's essentially synonymous with the formation of the Irish state and with independence, so it fulfills the same function as, you know, July the 4th in America, for example, or commemoration of the 12th of July does in Northern Ireland, and the Somme to a certain extent. So it's always relevant for that reason. And the other reason which Roisin has mentioned, and John, which I think is really central, is the notion of myth. And I think one, you know, useful definition of a myth is something in which the idea itself becomes of greater importance than the actual historical event. And I think the Easter Rising certainly fulfills that definition of myth, which means in a sense that it's always going to be relevant, because it's always going to be endlessly reinterpreted to suit whatever the prevailing historical climate is. And this is something which Roisin could probably speak about better than me, but at certain periods of history, then 1916 takes on very different meanings to other periods. In 1966, for example, the state is trying to co-opt 1916 to project a kind of constructive patriotism. With the Troubles, you know, most obviously, the meaning of 1916 becomes something much more kind of contested and problematic. And then, of course, with recent years, you know, for example, the 90th anniversary of the Rising, We see that with the ceasefire and the post-Troubles. Here, 1916 then again changes meaning and becomes a much more, you know, positive sort of celebration of identity. So that note, 1916 being really myth, being, you know, permanently changing, I think is central to its relevance and importance.
I'd like to jump in there and just say one thing that struck me today when I was reading over the notes I made on Irish Freedom, which was the IRB's newspaper beforehand. Now, you know, it's very obvious when you look at that the Rising is something that occurs in its own time and place, and the immediate context is important. Like, the IRB were very concerned with labour disputes, you know, before the First World War. Then they were very concerned with the First World War. They were concerned with things like the land issue. And I mean, it strikes me that the myth of the Rising, which is so powerful, has sort of obscured looking at it in its context. I wonder what other people agree with that.
Well, I think that was certainly something that the labour movement has complained about and felt. And you can also see that with the women's movement. You know, if there were three dominant strands in Irish history at that time, if we agree with Countess Markovitch, the labour movement, the women's movement and the national movement, certainly it's true that the national movement has dominated and pushed out all other struggles on the island. And that has had an impact on the way in which we read that back into history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think we almost have to sort of make clear whether we're talking about 1916, the historical event, with all its kind of complexities and messiness and the precise historical context of that event in its times, or 1916, the idea. Because I think a lot of them, when we're talking about 1916, the event, we're actually talking about 1916 as this kind of ever-changing receptacle for our ideas. And almost any great historical event, and somehow 1916 can be read into it. Like, for example, the economic crisis of the past couple of years. You know, when the people from the IMF arrive in Dublin, the Irish Times, you know, default position is to say, is this what the men of 1916 died for? So I think, you know, perhaps one of the things that we can try and do in the lead up to 2016 is to promote a greater understanding of 1916 as a historical event, as opposed to 1916 as a kind of myth, and to get a sort of sophisticated understanding of that out.
Well, Roisin, I was just going to ask you, one of the things people talk about when they talk about the way Irish history was taught during the 20th century, sometimes they say that 1916 was seen as the end point, the end of a struggle. Everything was leading up to that point, previous rebellions going back hundreds of years in history. And then there's the other idea that 1916 was the beginning. It started off the War of Independence, the Civil War, state building, all these different things. There doesn't seem to be a lot of interpretation of 1916 as just a point in the middle, that it had a backstory and also it led on to further things.
That's a really good point. And of course, it's exactly what Pierce designs, you know, that's exactly how he wants to see it. He wants it to be seen, he wants himself to be seen as part of this continuous struggle, this continuous line, you know, that dates from Cuchulainn and Jesus Christ right through to himself, and then beyond. You know, the Rising is a moment, you know, it speaks to the future as well as bringing the past into itself. So he positions himself as pivotal, and I think that's why sometimes Irish people then have struggled to place it. But I think you're absolutely right, and you know, as Fergal's been saying, one interesting thing is not to locate it necessarily as if the Rising itself not an end point, but of course the independent state is, that everything is leading up to the point of that of statehood, but it can't be an end point because of the six counties in the north. But you know, to locate it rather in European history at the beginning of the 20th century and to see it as part of the broader politics of Europe at that time.
Yeah, I mean, now just to add into that, I mean, I think we probably need to locate 1916 in a number of different contexts. And I think the rebels were so incredibly successful in theorising the idea of 1916 that it's sometimes difficult to go back to the event itself and see it in its correct context, including chronological. So, for example, if we look at the proclamation, there's a concerted attempt in the proclamation to place 1916 as almost the inevitable outcome of several centuries of insurrection, you know, going back to the 17th century, and projecting 1916 as a historical inevitability. But if you look at what a lot of the revisionist historians who are writing 1960s and 70s approach it, you know, they tend to much more place 1916 in the context of an extraordinary revolutionary decade that began in 1912, 1913 with the Home Rule crisis and then the impact of the Great War. And I suppose what I would argue is that we probably need to be alive to placing 1916 in a number of different contexts. So certainly it's a central event, maybe the pivotal event in Irish revolutionary politics in the decade from 1913 to 1923. But personally, I think there is something to be said for placing 1916 in longer context, including, as most of the generation who took part in 1916 did, as a kind of consequence of the cultural nationalist revolution of the late 19th century.
What was the political situation in Ireland leading up to 1916?
Well, the Easter Rising basically happened with a background of two huge events. One of them, huge in an Irish context, in a British context, was the Home Rule crisis, when the British Parliament had actually passed the Home Rule Bill it had been proposed in 1912, was passed in 1914. And this led to the formation of two rival militias, the Ulster Volunteers and the Irish Volunteers. So that's one, and that was probably not appreciated today as big of a crisis as it was. It was a huge crisis, not only in Ireland, but in Britain. The Conservative Party very famously flirted with the idea of helping the Ulster youth, the Ulster Volunteers, and encouraging the British Army not to follow orders, which is extremely extreme behaviour for loyal opposition. In Ireland, obviously, it opened the prospect of a civil war, an open civil war, although, I mean, I think personally that's a little bit exaggerated. I don't think they were really ready to fight each other, but that's one context. And if you look at what the separatists are saying, the separatists in the Irish Republican Brotherhood are very much a minority, and the other separatists, but they're really encouraged by this. I mean, they see this as the beginning of the revolution. The other thing is the First World War. I think you can't overstate enough how important the First World War is to the story of the Irish Revolution as a whole and the Easter Rising in particular, because one thing that it did was it asked a lot of people. You know, conscription wasn't imposed in Ireland, but they did try to recruit people. There was rationing, there was more repression, if you like. There was the DORA, the Defence of the Realm Act. They closed down newspapers, they banned meetings, not enough of them, they would say, like, they let the volunteers more or less do their thing. But those two kind of contexts, I think, are something that you can't see the Rising without.
It almost feels that Ireland has always been, well, the 26 counties at least, has always been independent. But to try and get into that frame of thinking where Ireland was an integral part of the UK, where we were sending MPs to Westminster, how revolutionary was this act? Not just to become part of the nationalist movement and seek a Home Rule Parliament, but a complete separation between Ireland and Britain. Like, how popular was that notion among Irish people?
It was a minority position. What's interesting, I mean, as you say, the, you know, the sense of Ireland as part of the United Kingdom at that time, I mean, that's very clear, obviously, if you read newspapers like the Irish Times and the Belfast Newsletter at that time, as I've been doing quite often at the minute, you know, that the London Correspondent is constantly writing. The reference is to that central London metropole, and, you know, the main cities in Ireland are very much, you know, are very much linked into that. And as you say, sometimes there is a sense in the 26 counties, not at all in the six, that Ireland has always been independent, and it's easy to forget just how strong those links with England were. But the Home Rule movement, that the nationalist movement, was a much more mainstream one than the separatist movement at that time, and Fergal has written eloquently about that.
Yeah, I mean, all I'd kind of add to that, maybe to bring the two previous points together a little bit, is you know, if you look at a map of Europe, you know, prior to 1914, you know, you've got a very small number of empires which ruled vast amounts of territory, and empire is the norm, and there's very few kind of nation states. And if you look at a map, you know, in 1922, 23, you have all these new nation states that have appeared, and they staked their claim on self-determination and democracy. And, you know, problematically with some of these nation states, you've got contested nationality sharing spaces, and you've got partition. And I think, you know, in the past, I think Irish people often lost sight of how the strength of the correlation between what happens in Ireland and the revolutionary period, not so much because of 1916, that's the pivot, but because of the experience of Great War and sort of fast-forwarding the emergence of democracies and imperial fragmentation. And, you know, so that's one point. But the other point is, if you go back and you look at the ideas of the very small minority who are advocating republicanism, you know, not the Irish Party, but the very small minority, you know, they're very kind of at the decline of nationality, and that home rule would be, you know, a terrible compromise that will end up with Ireland remaining within the UK state forever and so on. But in a sense, they radically get the drift of history wrong, because their 1916 is a radical, violent response to a fear which proves to be profoundly wrong, which is that the spirit of nationalism is declining and that the future lies with Ireland being part of some imperial state. So I think we need to think, I suppose, carefully about people's motivations and how they saw the world at the time. And there's a very interesting case for looking closely at what Home Rule signified at the time within Ireland, because to someone like John Redmond, it was a kind of a moderate compromise that would see nationalists achieve some measure of self-government within the UK state. To Republicans, it was a complete sellout, which justified a violent response. And probably Unionists were somewhere near the Republican position, because, rather than Unionists seeing Home Rule, whether 26 county or 32 county, as a kind of acceptable compromise, they really, got the ball of revolution rolling by having a potentially violent response to the prospect of Home Rule, which brought about a radicalisation of the situation.
It's funny though, it reminds me of the article Garrett Fitzgerald wrote for Studies in 1966, and he, because his father obviously was in the GPO, and Fitzgerald, he clearly, he's part of the, he was leader of the Fine Gael party, not in 66, but, so he clearly identifies with that tradition, with the Redmondite tradition. So I think in order almost to explain it to himself, he talks about the motivation of those who fought in the Easter Rising, and that Ireland's interests were becoming so firmly linked to British interests through the war effort, that if they hadn't acted then, the moment would have been lost. There would have been no will to do it. But what Fitzgerald, I think, also kind of interestingly at the end of it, he says, if you want to know what Home Rule in Ireland would have looked like, look north. And had they not done it at that time, the whole island would have become so dependent on British welfarism that there would never have been any strike for independence.
Yeah, and the other thing I'd add to that, I think Fitzgerald's take on 1916 is really interesting, because obviously he's part of the constitutional tradition. He's opposed to physical force republicanism in the sense of as it exists at the time, but he believes very firmly in the necessity of 1916. But I think one of the really, really good insights he has in the period is the very success of 1916, which very few people could have predicted at the time, almost led people to question the need for 1916. But going back to the mindset of the Republicans, it's very hard for us, I suppose, to understand the extent to which republicanism was so marginal before the event itself. And I think Roisin's point raises a very big question, which is, what would have happened had there been 1916? Would the future of Ireland be some kind of home rule or dominion type settlement, which would have represented a compromise between nationalism, perhaps retaining Ireland within the UK state or even within the British Empire? Or, would all of this have happened anyway? Because of the consequences of the Great War and what happens elsewhere in the post-war period. Personally, I think I'd have to put my hands up and say, I don't really know, but it's an interesting question to think about how necessary, effective was 1916 in sort of changing the course of Irish history.
You can look at it in a rational way, like Gareth Fitzgerald did in his article, say, to become self-sufficient, Ireland had to be independent and so forth. And you can look at it from a political point of view and look. And the Union is not that liberal, really. I mean, that Ireland is ruled by a guy in the Phoenix Park, or really by the Undersecretary for Ireland, and the police force are responsible to him. It's not democratic. So you can look at it in a rational way, but some of this I always feel is not tremendously rational. It's emotional, and I don't think it's wise to understate when we look back the emotional power of these things. Like Desmond Fitzgerald, who was Gareth's father, wrote that Ireland would be a place like England if there was no blood sacrifice, or something like that. And Sean McDermott is on record as saying the same thing. This idea of that what we are is going to be annihilated, if we don't assert our nationality. I think there's something very powerful in that, which is not rational at all, And mm-hmm. I think you see this in all nationalism, like in other nationalism that I'm a little bit familiar with, this in the Basque Country. I mean, ETA, when they were founded in the 60s, were talking in exactly the same way, that we'll become Spanish. We won't be Basque anymore. We won't be what we are. So some of it, I think, when you look at it, and I don't mean to say that the rebellion is an irrational thing, because that's a whole kind of school of thought, but I think it has that aspect to it as well.
But there is the other argument that revolutionary strikes, as opposed to nationalism, I suppose, but that are, that any kind of insurrection, in some ways what leads to it is that you have an elite group who have social power, perhaps economic power, and no political power. So that, you know, that what we see, maybe not on the, you know, maybe not on O'Connell Street in April 1916, but certainly in the run-up to that, in those forces of cultural nationalism, what we see are an elite group of Irish people who want to have power. It's not necessarily a democratic thriving there, I think, as much as people looking for their own power.
Do you think 1916 leaders were tapping into a latent separatism that was lurking just beneath the surface, that even among Irish Parliamentary Party voters there would have been a good chunk of them would have been favourable towards them? Or was it people got caught up in events as the executions, and people became more aware of the personalities of the people involved, almost followed along with the idea that it was a great sacrifice?
Just to jump in on that one, I mean, something I've spent a long time thinking about. I mean, the argument about, one argument about the Easter Rising is that the people who carried out the Rising were incredibly unrepresentative. I mean, it was a very small number of people who took part in the event itself. You know, most of them who had attempted to win any kind of political support had failed. The revolutionaries hadn't even really won the argument within separatism about whether there should be a rebellion. I think that's all sort of true to a certain extent, but then that leaves us with a very difficult question of how does their violence prove so successful, and how does it seem to transform public opinion so quickly, and how do we reach the situation that by 1918, essentially, you know, the masses, the Irish nationalist masses, have embraced republicanism, which before was never popular, and they've deserted this movement, constitutional nationalism, which was really the kind of the, you know, almost a hegemonic nationalist movement since the 1880s. And my thinking behind this would be that really, in terms of popular nationalism, people weren't necessarily signed up to constitutional nationalism or to home rule in this period. Essentially, they wanted a form of independence which identified with the values of nationalism. And what happens after the Easter Rising, it becomes clear that the Home Rule project, that constitutional nationalism, that the project itself has essentially collapsed, and popular nationalism, the way in which most people perceive the world, popular nationalism sort of identifies with republicanism. But again, they're not signing up to some kind of specifically republican ideological project. It's rather that instead of the Irish Party, the Home Rule being the vehicle which embodies their aspirations, it becomes Sinn Féin. But I don't think necessarily the forces that make up popular nationalism, Catholicism, cultural nationalism, a kind of a Gaelic identity, a very powerful sense of history, of struggle against Britain, and all of those interweaved with a consciousness of British discrimination and economic discrimination and other issues, that essentially republicanism becomes the vehicle for those popular nationalist aspirations. So I think, in a sense, it's neither home rule nor republicanism, in fact, are the political values that most Irish people subscribe to in any sort of ideological sense, but rather the success of these vehicles is at different times they manage to stand for the Irish nation, and that there is, perhaps isn't as big a gap between you know, being a home ruler in 1914 or being a Sinn Féiner in 1918 as we might imagine, even though on paper the political projects look very different.
John, one of the things that the latest History of Ireland are talking about, the monster meeting on Sackville Street for home rule, when Patrick Pearce was sharing a platform with John Redmond, and as Fergal said there, could people view Irish Parliamentary Party, Nationalist, Republican, Separatist, as just labels that they could interchange?
Well, I'd go along with what Fergal said there a lot, which is that there's this been kind of big blob of Irish nationalists, you know, who are not tremendously sophisticated, really, and I don't mean that as an insult, but who want independence for Ireland. And also, I think Irish nationalism means seeing history in a particular way. It means seeing Ireland has been conquered by England but now wants to be free, basically. And also, not exclusively, but also seeing the Catholic people as the nationalist people. Generally, that's a factor as well, to a greater or lesser extent. And another one thing that is not always appreciated as well is that the parliamentary party tradition celebrated fighting for Irish freedom in 1798, and the big commemorations in 1898. A lot of them were very kind of equivocal about the Boer War, for example. I mean, in Longford, there was a commemoration to a guy who died in 1644 every year with the Irish Party, you know, fighting the Scots, which the Irish Party would go along to. So, like, the idea of fighting for Ireland was there in the parliamentary party as well, although there was also some people at the top of it, people like Tom Kettle and Redmond himself, who thought being the British Emperor wasn't that bad a thing. But I agree with Fergal that it really isn't that big a step to get this big blob of people, push them a little bit further to demand independence rather than home rule.
I'm Roisin. There seems to be among separatists a real belief that the Irish Parliamentary Party is corrupt, it's weak, it's taken one compromise too far. Was that just among that group of people, or is that idea permeated throughout Irish society?
It is. It's an easy, I mean, the same thing was said, you know, I suppose, of Isaac Butt as well. You know, and the Labour Party in Britain said it about Labour politicians. Oh, once you go into the House of Parliament, you're already corrupted by the culture, you know. Mm. And that you become very influenced by the culture of it. And I think there was a feeling, I suppose, that, you know, that they'd maybe gone a little bit native in Britain. But that's always an easy criticism to make of any parliamentary party.
I think the vital catalyst we need to add to all this, which we've mentioned earlier, is, of course, the Great War. I think, you know, on paper, John Redmond in 1912 or 1913... the Irish Party win every seat. People don't, nationalists don't even contest against them. They're clearly all powerful in some ways. So it's what happens in the Great War. John Redmond's, you know, very kind of striking identification with the war effort, his willingness to commit his political party and the project of Home Rule on a very unambiguous support for the British war effort, which is kind of, you know, not part of the nationalist tradition. And so I think it's that. Had the Redmondite Home Rule project not, you know, had this terrible kind of issue timing, which is the Ulster crisis sparked by the Home Rule, but then the adoption of an incredibly unpopular position, which, you know, many Irish Party MPs were very uncomfortable with. You know, we would have seen a history unfold in very different ways. But it's this kind of twofold crisis, which I think, you know, essentially undermines the Redmondite political project.
Now, we're just going to take a very quick break, and we will be back shortly. Now, as Fergal was saying there before the break about the First World War, how big a factor was opposition to the First World War in coalescing all these different groups from the left, from republicanism, Sinn Féin, the Volunteers, the IRB? How big was opposition to the First World War a factor?
It's kind of a tricky question, that, because, and one of the reasons is because, as Fergal says, the Rising was really a conspiracy within a conspiracy. It wasn't like they built massive popular support and did it. No, they did it and then they looked for popular support afterwards. But I think, from what I know, which is mainly based on the Irish Freedom newspaper, which was banned in 1914, not long after the war broke out, but the war really does seem to have been seen by separatists as the final straw. You know, they couldn't stand the idea of Irish people going to fight for Britain, because it was, you know, it's like this annihilation of everything that they believed Irishness was about. So for them, I mean, actually, people in the IRB, Clark and McDermott, Tom Clark and Sean McDermott, have been talking about a rising anyway, I think. But it definitely decided them that they were going to have to do it now. But so, yeah, with the rising was definitely a catalyst. I mean, I think, though, that a kind of intangible thing is people getting used to a lot of people being killed and violence being used. I think that had a factor. James Stevenson wrote a book about the Easter Rising as a kind of a diary. He said that. I think that afterward, the rising, opposition to the war was very important, obviously, when there was the threat of conscription being imposed. And people went along with the war when it didn't cost them too much, really. But then when it was a lot of people were going to be killed, that the rising was causing, or sorry, that the war was causing a lot of hardship in terms of rationing and stuff, I think it did become important. And also, the repression after the rising was facilitated by the Wartime Acts, the Defence of the Realm Act, which meant that people could be picked up and interned, and presses could be closed down and so on. I think that had a big impact.
So, Fergal, how do we get to the point where Patrick Pearse is actually reading out a proclamation outside the GPO on Easter Monday?
Well, actually, this question relates quite nicely to John's point about the Great War. I was making the point that the Great War really sort of shows the fragility of the Home Rule project and really puts constitutionalism to a test that it doesn't survive. But this is really only evident over the course of the war in general, I mean, from 1914 to 1918. And if there's one particular issue which really, I think, destroys the Rule Party after the Easter Rising, it's the conscription crisis of 1918. But if you go back to the outbreak of the war in 1914, 1915, what's kind of interesting is that Redmond sort of wins the political argument that it's necessary to support the British war effort. And we can actually measure very, well, reasonably precisely how Irish nationalists felt on the question. If we look at the split that took place in the Irish volunteer movement, which was hugely popular in the summer of 1914, probably had, you know, 150,000 members or something like that. And when Redmond says, you know, basically makes the case that it's tactically necessary to support the British war effort and to be pragmatic in order to win home rule, probably over 90% of the Irish volunteers back Redmond, and, you know, 5 to 10% of the Irish volunteers adopt a more separatist position, which is anti-war and which is implicitly revolutionary. You know, but even within these groups, there's probably a small majority who feel the revolution should only take place at the right moment rather than just at any given moment. So that's kind of interesting. It shows us how marginal the insurrectionists are. And basically what happens between 1914, to bring us to the steps of the GPO, is that a very determined faction within that 5 or 10% of Irish nationalism organise a fairly well-organised conspiracy to bring about an uprising. And the very scale of the uprising, the fact that it involves less than 2,000 people in Dublin, I think shows how marginal was the view that there should be an insurrection. So I think it's important to be conscious of that. The other point perhaps I'd mention in terms of the actions of people like Pearce perhaps is that it was probably inevitable that the group that was most determined to have some action were going to be successful, because really there wasn't very much that separatists who disagreed with them could do. So it was kind of inevitable that some kind of action would occur. But it's quite interesting to see the sort of the lengths to which people like Clark and McDermott and Pearce had to go to bring about that event, because essentially they had to organise really a sort of a secret conspiracy. And, you know, they went to the extent of kidnapping people like Bulmer Hobson who disagreed with them to bring this about. So the conspiracy came about, I suppose, essentially because a very small but determined group of people were determined to really do anything possible to strike. And I think it's quite interesting to think psychologically about what the reasons for that might be, because you're looking at a group which brings together very different viewpoints: cultural nationalists, socialists, Fenians, and they all have quite different views on things. But I think the one thing that really brings together is that they believe it's vitally important to do something to change the way events are going. And the war is central to this, but it's not the notion that the war shows that there's, you know, a wind behind their back and popular support for a popular revolution. Rather, it's almost precisely the opposite. The war shows how marginalised they are. The war is, you know, Redmond's position is reasonably popular. A lot of people are joining the war effort, and it reinforces this sense that something must be done to change the course of Irish history, or, as you were mentioning earlier, Ireland will end up like Scotland or Wales. The spirit of kind of separatist nationalism will die.
And John, what was the actual military plan that they had?
Well, nobody really knows exactly what the plan was. It was because it was kept completely secret. It was apparently made by Joseph Plunkett, and supposedly he based on Robert Emmet's plan in 1803. Now, I don't know if that's completely right, but the idea was that they'd seize the central part of Dublin, roughly in a circle, between the canals, and that they would hold the line of the Shannon with the rifles that they'd get from Germany. The Germans were sending them captured Russian rifles. The people from Cork would march into Connacht, and there'd be some sort of last stand there. I mean, the plan, if you want to look at it as a blueprint for taking over a country, it's completely off the wall, could not have worked. But I don't think that was ever the plan. I think Fergal could say more about that, maybe.
Yeah, I think there's probably, I mean, people would disagree, but I think there's probably been too much written about the plan, because I think the plan, as John said, I think the plan was kind of mad. I don't think it was a plan. I think really what 1916 was about was a sort of, it was a highly orchestrated and symbolic gesture in which a sort of insurrection would be used as a form of propaganda to draw attention to the separatist case. And obviously that's an idea that's associated with Patrick Pearce, with the blood sacrifice, and also the notion of the need for a violent insurrection is also in a less mystical form associated with the Fenians. But even if you look at kind of ordinary separatists who took part in 1916, many of them say things along the same lines. They say, well, things were going the wrong way and we knew that something must be done to change things around. So my sense would be that to read too much into the military plans and logistics would be to miss the point of 1916, which is that it was essentially a kind of a sort of a desperate gesture, which some people just felt honour-bound to make, regardless of whether they thought it would be successful or not. But I think some revolutionaries actually did hold the feeling that it in time, actually, produce political benefits. If you go back to looking at the views of people who were separatists, who opposed Easter Rising, like Owen McNeill, it's quite interesting that they very explicitly make the point there's no point in having an insurrection of this sort if it can't achieve anything in military terms. And that's a very rational argument, but I would argue that ultimately they were wrong, because 1916 was, you know, incredibly successful as a form of politics rather than as a kind of a military or an insurrectionary effort.
And just to add to that, it's said that Desmond Fitzgerald was in charge of rations in the GPO, and he was the only person who believed that it would be a long, drawn-out battle. And so he fed them very poorly in the GPO. They were getting sick on the biscuits in Jacob's factory. But, everybody else knew it wouldn't last for very long.
Well, Roisin, just talking about the leaders of 1916, they're far more complex and interesting characters than the almost the plaster saints they became later on in the 20th century.
That's absolutely true, and it's not more true of anybody than it is of Patrick Pearse. He's partly responsible for that. He did set himself up as a Christian martyr, and therefore was very useful to the Catholic Irish state. So Pearse certainly fulfilled that role as a moral exemplar, as well as rather even than a military one. The radicalism gets lost very much, I think, in the way that they are all remembered. That's not an unusual thing to happen, though, in any society. You know, you try to sideline the violence in order that the so-called founding fathers can send out a different message.
And John, some of the work that you've done recently about casualties, civilian casualties, particularly in Easter week, how did you find reading through those records?
I'd like to say that the research really isn't mine. It's based on Eunan O'Halpin's work at Trinity College with the Dead of the Irish Revolution, the name of the project is. And they have a figure of 487 now of the deaths in Easter week, of whom about 200 are combatants. So that's nearly 300 civilians. And if you remember that the fighting is all in 5 days maximum, and probably four, because there wasn't an awful lot of fighting on the Monday, that's kind of chilling. So most of the casualties seem to have been killed in the crossfire, but there were quite a few occasions. First of all, when the rebels took over their positions, they did deliberately kill civilians. We don't really have a figure on how many it was, but they did do it. They did shoot people who got in their way. And the British troops, on one occasion in North King Street, they broke into houses and they shot 15 men out of hand. Apparently they had orders to do this, to not take any prisoners. But there was also an officer in Portobello Barracks who seized Francis Sheehy Skeffington, who was the famous pacifist and orator who was out trying to stop looting. And he shot him, and he shot six other people, and very stupidly he shot a newspaper editor, which you don't want to do. But the British do seem to have caused most of the casualties once the rising broke out. Now, if you want to talk about the moral argument, you could say no rising, no civilian casualties, which makes sense. But the British forces do seem to have caused most of the actual civilian casualties.
And Fergal, you've been doing some work with the Bureau of Military History, and especially with your latest book as well. What type of motivations did you find for the ordinary volunteers in the Irish Volunteers and the Irish Citizen Army that decided to go out and fight in Easter week?
The Bureau is an unusual source, because people sort of record a witness statement of their actions and in a kind of a narrative form. We talk about maybe joining the Gaelic League and becoming a nationalist and becoming a Republican. But they tend not to actually talk about motivations in explicit terms. And, one of the concerns I had in using the witness statements as a source is the difficulty of on the one hand, it's a really valuable insight into what ordinary people talk about politics and what they were doing this period. But on the other hand, they simply didn't talk in a very explicit fashion about their motivations. But the things I did notice from it, I suppose one theme which struck me as kind of interesting is that outside of the small number of activists and kind of leaders who were motivated in sort of terms of clear political ideology, and they had all sorts of disputes about what was wrong with Griffith's idea of a dual monarchy and why republicanism was the only way forward and so on. The thing that struck me most was that how many people who took part in 1916 didn't have a very clear sense of ideological motivation above and beyond a clear sense of wanting to fight for Irish freedom. There doesn't seem to have been a very strong sense of the precise nature of which that freedom should take, whether it should be, for example, a republican state, or the importance of perhaps social and economic issues within that view of freedom. So going back to sort of, you know, one of the really successful aspects of the Easter Rising is the proclamation itself and the reading of the proclamation. And that, I think, popularizes, certainly brings into prominence a very radical set of clear political goals, but in terms of social and economic equality and gender equality and republicanism and so on. But the thing that most struck me looking at kind of ordinary accounts is that how even quite a number of people who took part in 1916 were surprised that a republic was proclaimed. That was almost incidental to what they're about, which was fighting for Irish freedom. And if we look at the sort of the backgrounds of those who were involved, well, most of them were Irish volunteers. I mean, so you could expect maybe people in the IRB and people in the military council to have a sort of a clear sense of what they were doing. But for a lot of people, you know, they were essentially nationalists. They were fighting for Irish freedom. And I would argue that that's perhaps one of the reasons why subsequently in the independent Irish state, you know, we don't have a very strong sense of republicanism. Republicanism sort of condenses down to the use of force to win Irish independence from Britain, rather than maybe some of the more radical social goals that we would have identified with people like Patrick Pearse or with the Fenian generation of the late 19th century.
But Fergal, just to pick up on that, was there many witness statements from people who were involved in the Irish Citizen Army? And did they express any hope that an Irish Republic would lead to a socialist republic?
Not many. I mean, there were plenty of witness statements by individuals involved in the Citizen Army, but they're not particularly radical. I mean, one assumes that because they're in the Citizen Army that they did subscribe to these beliefs. But the analysis and the witness statements doesn't seem to be very different, certainly in some of the cases, than the kind of witness statements that you would get from members of the Fenians or other groups. I mean, I wouldn't like to overgeneralize about that. I mean, I think there are some differences. The role of women, for example, comes across much more strongly in the accounts of the Citizen Army, and they include more witness statements by women. But the other thing which I think you need to factor in here is the witness statements were taken in the 1940s and the 1950s. And to be a kind of, to the whole notion of what revolutionary socialism and communism and Marxism, and these things really meant something very different in the 1940s and 1950s in a country which had become far more kind of Catholic and conservative than was the case in the 1910s, and Easter Rising took place before the Russian Revolution, which would have had such a big impact. So I kind of agree with the point that Roisin was making earlier, which is it's really easy to lose sight of the radicalism because the world and Ireland had changed so much between the 1910s when amazing things seemed possible, particularly to revolutionaries who joined groups like the Citizen Army, and the 1940s and 1950s when you really had a conservative nationalism. So I wouldn't like to say just because you don't have a lot of class politics in the witness statements, even from members of the Citizen Army, that means that they were, you know, more conservative than we might think.
Roisin, just to get back to that point, if you were to put the 1916 Rising into a context of different uprisings and revolutions throughout Europe during the First World War, if you look at the Russian Revolution or mutinies on the front with French soldiers or social revolutions in the wake of the First World War, for people outside Ireland, if they were looking at 1916 in that period, did you get much of an impression that maybe it was viewed as a spark, or do we have a habit of in Ireland of thinking that everyone is paying attention to us?
Well, we certainly, I think, yes, we overstate our importance around the world. But there's no doubt that the fact that Ireland had risen was extremely important. It was important in Germany, it was reported. It was, you know, so the enemies of Britain at that during the First World War certainly knew about it. And it was, I mean, certainly subsequently it became very important across the British Empire, you know, that Ireland had, you know, had taken this stand. India was very influenced by it. So there is a domino effect. I mean, it shouldn't be overstated because, of course, all the those other countries within the British Empire had their own nationalist movements, and you know, had their own causes, but they looked to that example, and you know, and Britain, you know, it, Ireland has always been strategically important, not just because of it, because it's, you know, the back way into Britain. It's strategically important because if Britain can't control Ireland, then where is it going to be able to control?
And John, just to look at the aftermath of 1916 and the British response, how much that played into the hands of the revolutionaries, or how much of it was a case where they didn't really know what to do with this situation?
Again, one of the elements of the old story is that, you know, had there been no executions, there would have been no popular reaction, and, you know, British rule would have been saved and Irish history would have been different forever. I think that's probably exaggerated, but it's obviously true to some extent, right? Because if you look at the RIC reports, the RIC gave these really detailed reports of public opinion in each county and in each section of each county to Dublin Castle. And they all said that while public opinion thought the Rising was a mad affair, they were very against the rebels being punished. And that's true in Wexford and in Cavan, which are the two places that I've happened to look at. And I suspect it's true in lots of other places. So because they were seen within the nationalist tradition, as Fergal's been saying, like they were fighting for Irish freedom, whatever that meant, but that was, you know, that was how they were seen. However misguided they were one of us, and they're fighting the old enemy. People didn't want to see them punished, and people were outraged when the leaders were shot within a few days of surrendering, because it was a very summary process. And also, I mean, as I kind of alluded to in the last when I was speaking last, the British military did behave quite badly in Dublin, mostly because of cumbersomeness of regular military. But also, I mean, even unionists afterwards complained about the military occupation of the city and the curfew. Around the country, though, what's really interesting is there was an article which talked about the arrests in Roscommon. Now, in Roscommon town, the only thing that happened in the Easter Rising was somebody hoisted the tricolour over the town hall. And yet, they sent a cavalry column there which surrounded the town, and they arrested several hundred people and marched them away, you know. So I think that there's no doubt, although it might have been exaggerated, there's no doubt that the repression after the Rising, including the executions and the arrests, and I mean, there's over 3,000 arrests, of whom only about 1,500 are kept in custody. But what's perceived as an overreaction against the nationalist community as a whole is really important. While from an Irish point of view, you know, this gives people the opportunity to talk about English tyranny and so forth, I mean, in the context of repression of rebellions in Europe, it's no big deal. Like, if you look at the Paris Commune, which is in some ways, you know, it's in some ways very different, but in other ways it's a rebellion in wartime in the capital city. I mean, there's over 20,000 people who were just summarily executed by the French government or the anti-communard government. I mean, but even more closely, if you look at the Spartacist uprising after the First World War in Germany, again, there's in working class districts of some of the German cities, I mean, the military and the working militaries went in and they killed all around them. And that did not happen in Ireland. So there is a danger of exaggerating how bad the repression afterwards was. But having said that, yeah, it was clearly very important in alienating nationalist opinion.
We're coming towards the end of the show, but just talk about how 1916 has been commemorated in the years since. How important 1916 was to the founding myth of the state.
Well, it is important to the founding myth of the state, but it hasn't continuously been commemorated by the state. And in fact, it's been very problematic. You know, sometimes a damaged brand, it's not an easy brand for the state because of its the central violence, and because it declares a republic and there are people who don't think that republic has been achieved. So in representing an Irish nationhood, it always, it seems to me, represents a challenge to the state, to the state anyway, and certainly to a partition state. So throughout then there are some key commemorations. The first anniversary of the Easter Rising, several thousand people gather on O'Connell Street, stones are thrown. So as Claire Wills points out, first commemoration is a riot. And many of the commemorations, the Easter Rising is an event that's best commemorated informally in some ways, most successfully through songs, poems, calendars, you know, the kitsch representations. The state has always struggled to have, you know, the formal commemorative event, the parade down O'Connell Street, the reading of the proclamation. It's not very exciting, you know, compared to more subversive elements. But the first military parade was 1924. And then the 10th anniversary, I suppose, is most famous for the riots in the Abbey when Ploughing the Stars was shown. And then the 1935, the Cuchulainn statue was placed in the GPO. I think that's the only statue in the capital city for the rising itself to commemorate that event. The GPO, of course, stands as, you know, as the monument to it. But the Children of Lurn, the Garden of Remembrance is dedicated to all those who gave their lives to Irish freedom. So it's not for Easter 1916 itself. And then as we move through, we see in 1941 a very, you know, problematic commemoration because it takes place during the Second World War. So to have a celebration or a huge military event is seen as not quite the thing. But at the same time, Ireland wants to demonstrate that it is its own military power and that it is a neutral country. So there is a parade down O'Connell Street to which really is a statement of independence. And then, of course, there's the big event in 1966, which is the largest commemoration to date. And some people think was a catalyst in the north in terms of increasing tensions, which eventually led to the outbreak of conflict in 1968. It wasn't, but it neither did it help. You know, there were lots of commemorations of the Easter Rising, and of course that year, 1966, is also the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Battle of the Somme. So you have these two. You have the UVF being reformed, and you know so blood is up. You know. And then after that, after the outbreak of the Troubles in 1968, the rising, the military parade is stopped on O'Connell Street, I think in 1972. And by the time you get to the 75th anniversary, there's a very muted commemoration by the state in the south. The most interesting thing about that commemoration, though, is not what they do in the Republic. It's what Martin McGuinness says in Milltown Cemetery. And he says very clearly, nobody joined the Provisional IRA because of what happened in 1916. They joined because of what was happening in 1968 and 1969. So even, I mean, it's all part of the IRA positioning itself for peace. And what they say is this is a conflict that is based in this society, and we must sort it out in this society. And it also is, this conflict can end before a united Ireland, whereas if you say the legacy of 1916, you have to keep on fighting until you get that. So the Easter Rising, the commemorations of the Easter Rising, and then of course, as Fergal mentioned earlier, the 2006 commemoration was really a celebration of the Celtic Tiger. It was about the independent state saying, yes, people said we couldn't do it, but look at us. We've got the greatest economy in the world. And, there are always two elements, it seems to me, in commemorations of the rising that really drive it. And one is the economy of the Republic. It's always about how successful the independent state is. And the other is partition of the island. And I think those two features will be there in the centenary. It's just how they'll be there and whether or not what we'll see in the centenary is an acceptance of partition. The economy, I'll leave to somebody else to predict.
As some commentators have said, by holding the 1916 leaders up for admiration, you're encouraging other people to emulate their actions. Do you think that's true?
I think as Roisin says, it's all about the context. And I think during the Troubles, I think 1916 was a particularly tricky kind of issue, because some of the issues at the core of interpretations of 1916 were unavoidably central to interpretations of the Troubles. You know, can a minority use violence? Can a minority without popular support use violence? Can their actions be retrospectively justified by popular support? You know, what's the moral basis for this? Can you, to what extent can one legitimize compromises that fall short of the Republic? So I think an awful lot of the public discussions of the history of the Rising for several decades have been, you know, really coded and not so coded debates about the morality of the Troubles. I think commemoration generally is is not about the past, but it's about how we choose in the present to view the past. And if you look at what people are saying now in Northern Ireland, particularly politicians, about how 2016 should be remembered, I think it's hugely encouraging, because there's lots of talk about, from people within the DUP and Sinn Féin, talking about the need not just to remember the Easter Rising, but to remember the Great War, and to remember the wider revolutionary events, and to remember Home Rule, and to put things in a wider context. And I think also one of the things that we should perhaps hope to do is to put events in Ireland in not just a European context of the Great War, but also to put them in the context of Britain. I mean, what happens in the revolutionary decade in Ireland also has, you know, a profound effect on Britain. I mean, the nature of the British state changes, you know, enormously with the Irish Revolution. So, personally speaking, I think this could be the first major commemoration in which we begin to see people thinking about 1916 in a much more interesting way, and looking at republicanism alongside unionism and loyalism, but also looking at you know, Ireland in its British and European context, and being perhaps people who in the past would have used 1916 basically to make narrow political points, whether in support or in opposition, to actually, you know, being much more willing to talk about some of the complexities and the contradictions. And, you know, touch wood, if the political context, particularly in the North, remains one of political progress and reconciliation, I think the tone of 2016 will be, you know, very different to all the previous major commemorations.
Well, unfortunately, the clock has beaten us. I'd just like to say thank you very much to all our guests here today. Fergal McGarry, Roisin Higgins, John Dorney, thank you very, very much. And we will see you again next time.